I'm really glad to be with you tonight, and I know we're on a tight schedule here. You all need to get out of here within an hour. I'm going to try and talk for about 35 minutes or so. We're going to show a couple, two or three clips, we'll see, and talk a little bit about how I've been influenced in my work on film by the writings of C.S. Lewis. Let me say a little bit about Lewis. You all probably know something about Lewis, probably read some work of Lewis. I mean, an enormously productive scholar who wrote scholarly works on medieval and Renaissance literature and philosophy. He also wrote lots of fiction. You're probably familiar with the Narnia series. We were just talking about what I think is his best piece of fiction, Till We Have Faces. He also wrote Christian apologetics. He wrote this odd little set of letters, the Screwtape Letters. One of the interesting things about Lewis's legacy, he's had a huge influence in Christian apologetics, of course, but one of the interesting things about his legacy is the way in which people have found resources for drama, so that there's a kind of one-man play of the Screwtape performance of the Screwtape Letters that goes around the country. There was an off-Broadway play that is called Freud's Last Session, which I think is probably the most interesting of the dramatic performances. It was actually based on a script that was based on a book that was based on a class at Harvard taught by a psychologist. And it was a class that was about Freud and Lewis. And Professor Nicoli, there's a PBS special on this. And then the book is called The Question of God. And he may still be teaching it for all I know. But the class had a huge wait list. It was a small class. It was only about 20 students. And the professor would arrange it so that half the class was composed of skeptics and atheists, and the other half was composed of believers. And I actually have a former student who was in that class at one point. He said it was the only place at Harvard where things were that even between believers and unbelievers in a class. And they would go through Freud's worldview and Lewis's worldview, which is really interesting comparison there, because as you may know, Lewis, while he was baptized fairly young, then had a long period of disaffection from the church, was an agnostic for a long period, and then had a conversion experience. And Freud sort of starts out practicing Judaism and then moves in a secular point. So their trajectories overlap, and this is the play's an imagined conversation between them. It's very interesting. Lewis, I think, would be, if we think about Lewis and film, and what can film teach us about faith, I think Lewis would have some degree of skepticism about so-called Christian films, many of which are fine and entertaining. I'm thinking, and there was a big number of these after Mel Gibson's surprise big hit with The Passion of the Christ, which I may say something about toward the end. I think it's a really interesting film, imperfect but impressive in lots of ways. But after an R-rated religious film in Aramaic with subtitles made a lot of money, Hollywood thought, maybe there's an audience out there we can make money off of, a Christian audience. And so we had films like God Is Not Dead. In fact, there's been a trilogy of those. Heaven Is For Real, then the whole Left Behind series, that are really targeted at a kind of Christian audience. I think, and these films vary in quality from one to another, I think the thing that I find problematic about those films is the same thing that I find problematic about a lot of mainstream Hollywood films with very heavy-handed liberal secular messages, which is that you always get the sense that the art is serving a kind of propaganda, that it's serving a message rather than the art lifting you to see the world differently. To put that slightly differently, I think those films are too heavy on the certitude of their message and too weak on developing our imaginations. So if we think about Lewis's own work, Lewis, if you think about the Narnia series and sort of going through the back of the case where the coat case there, and the kids finding their way into this world, this magical world. If you think about the way in which Lewis thought that fantasy, which takes us out of the ordinary and brings us into the realm of the extraordinary, the role of the imagination there for Lewis in fiction is absolutely crucial. Also, the Screwtape Letters is just an ingenious idea, right? Instead of writing directly, do this, don't do that, in a directly theological way, Lewis decides he's gonna invent these two characters who are demons. One's an older demon, one's a younger demon. And he's gonna write the book as a series of letters from the older demon to the younger demon on how basically to lead a soul away from heaven and to hell. So Lewis reverses the common way in which we approach theology, right? The common way in which we approach theology is to say, here's what God says, and we need to avoid contradicting that. We need to live in accord with it. That's all very important. But Lewis thinks in the realm of fiction and in the realm of art and film more generally, we need to use indirection. We need to move people out of their ordinary assumptions and let them see things from a perspective that surprises them. There's a great line toward the end of this book that I mentioned by the psychologist Nicole at Harvard, where he tries to sum up the difference between Freud and Lewis. And I think this is really important. It's really important for how he contrasts them. I think it's also important for how we think about Lewis and how we think about Lewis and art and film for this lecture. So Freud's always sort of castigating people and saying, grow up, right? His work on religion, The Future of an Illusion, assumes that God is basically a father image that we've projected onto the cosmos when we grow up and want to think about the world as a place that we're comfortable in. So that we make up God as a kind of projection of the father figure onto the cosmos. And for Freud, that's because we're all still trapped in infancy to some extent, right? Our childhood, for good and for ill, forms us. And so Freud's constantly saying, grow up, get over it. Lewis, on the other hand, is constantly saying to people, wake up. Wake up. You're sleepwalking. Wake up and see what the real world is like. So that Freud is constantly saying that we're believing in illusions and we need to move into the hard reality. Lewis is saying that we're in a world of dreams and we need to wake up to something that's much richer. So Freud's taking the interesting things from us and saying, you need to get rid of those. Lewis is saying, the things you believe right now, you're barely scratching the surface. You need to wake up and enter into this much richer world. That means that our art has got to surprise us. It's got to feed our imagination in a way that we're brought out of our ordinary assumptions and into a much more interesting and rich reality. One of the things that Lewis says, and I think this applies to our culture more generally today, but it applies to a lot of the kind of heavy-handed messaging that I think we get in certain strains of Hollywood movies where the characters or the plot are teaching us implicitly to see through things. So you've been told that religion is this way, but look at it this way and then see through it. You've been told that justice is one thing. Look at it this way and then see through it. You've been told that the family is one thing. But look at it from this angle and see through it. The problem, as Lewis says, about this modern habit of seeing through things is that the only reason to see through something is to see something else. If you're just seeing through things to show that those things are hollow or empty and not seeing anything else, then Lewis says you're blind. So we have a culture, particularly in our art, that is often a kind of blindness masquerading as clever insight, right? Masquerading as an insight that you thought religion, family, justice, things like this were important. They're really not. They're really hollow and empty. And Lewis thinks we do need to see through things, but we need to see through in order to see something deeper. I think for Lewis, one of the things that art has to do as well for us is to teach us what we're missing from day to day in our lives, what we're especially missing in our contemporary life. You know, Lewis was a great, he started out, even before his conversion, as a great lover of kind of Nordic and Irish myth. And this is the sort of roots of his own conversion, studying fiction. The Christian fiction writer George MacDonald, he read his work and said that his imagination was Christian before his mind and heart were. So his imagination was led in a certain direction. But Lewis loved old tales. And then when he studied philosophy and literature, he studied mainly medieval and Renaissance figures. And Lewis loved this image that the medievals had that we are like dwarfs standing on the shoulders of giants. We can see further than our predecessors because we stand on what they have achieved. In the modern world, Lewis thinks, we think we're giants destroying the dwarfs of the past. So our attitude to the past has completely changed in the modern world. From an older view where we receive and honor what we've gotten from the past and then build upon it, to a modern view that what we're about is escaping from the past and announcing ourselves as superior to it. Lewis thought it was important, if you were reading books, to have at least one out of every three books be an old book. Why did he think that? Because he thought there was a certain kind of tyranny that we were especially prey to in the modern world, which is the tyranny of the present. You don't hear that phrase. Lewis thought that we were subject to the tyranny of the present, of thinking that the only things that have significance in our lives are what is right in front of us right now, and that the past is completely irrelevant. Lewis, I think, thought it was important to read older things, not only older things, and to study older art because it would point out, it would give us a perspective from which to see deficiencies in our own current society and culture. I'm going to shift tone here rather dramatically because I want to show two clips that I think pick up on this theme of things that are missing or absent or disordered. I want to show first a brief clip from Batman Begins, and I'll say some things about that, and then I'm going to show a short clip from the film Gravity. But let's watch this short clip. I didn't use the interrogation scene or anything from Batman. We've got something a lot lighter here.
You guys will see back there.
Master Wayne, you've been gone a long time.
Yes, I have.
You look very fashionable. Pardon, madam. Are you coming back from Gotham for long?
As long as it takes. I want to show the people of Gotham their city doesn't belong to the criminals and the corrupt.
In the Depression, your father nearly bankrupted Wayne Enterprises combating poverty. He believed that his example could inspire the wealthy of Gotham to save their city. In a way, their murder shot the wealthy and the powerful into action.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol, I can be incorruptible, I can be everlasting.
What symbol?
Something elemental, something terrifying.
I assume that as you're taking on the underworld, this symbol is a persona to protect those you care about from reprisals.
You think about Rachel?
Actually, sir, I think to myself.
Have you told anyone I'm coming back?
I just couldn't figure the legal ramifications of bringing you back from the dead.
Dead?
You've been gone 7 years.
You have me declared dead.
Well, actually, it was Mr. Earl. He's taken the company public. He wanted to liquidate your majority shareholding. Those shares are worth quite a bit of money.
Well, that's a good thing I left everything to you, then.
Quite so, sir. And you can borrow the rolls if you like. Just bring it back with a full tank.
Okay. A nice clip. He's just come back from being with the League of Shadows, right? Is about to go back into Gotham and adopt his elemental image of the bat. There are these great scenes in this first of Nolan's trilogy where he's in the Batman outfit and he's on the top of these buildings with these great spires. And when I first saw that, I said, that's a medieval cathedral. That's what that looks like. And what does Batman look like? Batman looks like a gargoyle on a medieval cathedral. But it's a different world from the medieval world that Lewis, what Lewis called in one book, the discarded image, this medieval worldview. In Gotham, Batman is a gargoyle in a godless Gotham. Right? This is a world where, from which God appears to have departed, or at least has no relevance. It's also a world where there's no natural justice and where there's no civil justice. Right? The police and the courts, with a few small exceptions, are all corrupt. And the few good people who are left in the city are so timid and afraid that they don't do anything to fight what's bad. What's interesting about that, a world in which divine, natural, and human justice have all but disappeared, the question of Batman is what's left? Well, in Batman, what's left is the hunger in the soul for justice, right? That's what Batman represents. He represents a kind of last-ditch effort to keep that hunger for justice that's natural to the human soul alive in the midst of all sorts of obstacles, right? You remember the scene, there are lots of great scenes, but there's one scene where he's trying to find out what the criminals are plotting, and he's got that sort of a yo-yo machine that he throws down and he pulls the bad guy up in front of his face. He's hanging upside down on the side of the building and he's trying to get the details about this drug deal that's going to go down. And the guy says that, I'm telling you the truth, I swear to God. Batman pulls him right up close and says, one, don't swear to God, swear to me. Right? An indication that I don't think Batman is sort of advocating atheism there. I think what's going on is that's an indication in the film that the only kind of justice that's left is the justice that Batman might bring to that world. Right? So what's also interesting, I think, is that we live increasingly in a world where we're inarticulate about the most important things. We don't have a rich vocabulary for suffering, for virtue, for vice, for evil, for death. Our culture struggles. We don't have a public shared language for these things. The military has a language for these things. Some churches have languages for these things. But at large, in American culture, we've lost a language of these things. What Batman's also saying about that elemental symbol is not just that it's something, as he says, to fight fear with fear and to counteract evildoers. It's also something that will what? Inspire ordinary people. Ordinary people, he says, need examples, right? That is, to go back to Lewis's language, we need stories. We need a vocabulary to feed our moral imagination, or else our moral imagination atrophies and we become mute in the face of the most important human realities. Lewis said at one point, I want to play the gravity clip in just a second. And I'll play the gravity clip and then I'll read this passage from Lewis. But at the end of Lewis's book on the four loves, the last chapter is about charity. And Lewis says, you know, a lot of saints have written about the practice of the presence of God. This is a famous kind of meditation in the Catholic tradition, practice the presence of God. And Lewis said, you know, it's probably equally important for us to practice the absence of God. And I'm going to read what he said about that in a minute, but this is sort of what I'm getting at with some of the most important ways in which art works in our culture is not to directly present fully worked out truths. It's to point out what we're missing, to point out what we lack, and to show how important it is that we focus on those things that we lack. I take it that the Batman movies are reminding us that our civil order is very often disordered, that we lack justice. And what are we willing to do to preserve justice, to protect the innocent, to fend off evil? This is a really interesting scene in Gravity. The Sandra Bullock floating in outer space, this Cuarón movie, it's really well done. And detached from the main spaceship and thinking that she's gonna die, right? She's got a radio contact with someone that's fading in and out. There's a dog barking. He appears to be speaking Chinese. So if you hear her kind of talking to someone, this is what's going on. Let's show this clip real quickly here. You can hear the radio right there at the end, the transmitter. This is a really astonishing scene, I think, in a mainstream Hollywood film. Think about all the people who die in Hollywood films. Some films in the kind of horror slasher genre, that's all they do is die, right? Almost every scene, people are just dying. But people die a lot in Hollywood films. Can you recall films where, I mean, a lot of people die in the middle of a battle, or they die without expecting that they're going to die. But you still do have people who are dying, like Sandra Bullock thinks she's about to do here. How many of them ever pray? How many of them ever think about what's going to happen to them after they die? In an ordinary, not these Christian films that I mentioned earlier, right? Not many. Not many. And yet, vast numbers of ordinary people, if they know they're going to die, at least in their own heads, think about, wonder about, are anxious about, pray about the state of their soul and what's going to happen to them next. This film, right in the middle, just sort of comes out of nowhere. There's some other interesting symbols in this thing, but this sort of comes out of nowhere. And it's got two great moments in it, one at the beginning and then one at the end, I think. The first thing is, she says at the beginning, we're all going to die, I know that, but I'm going to die today. So she is particularizing this vague question about mortality. I'm going to die today, and what's going to happen to me? I'm here alone. No one will mourn for me. No one will pray for my soul. And then at the end, when she says, I could pray, nobody ever taught me how. She's articulating there the crucial things that have been missing in her own life that would have prepared her for this moment of death. No one taught her how to pray. She's there. This is, prayer is weighing on her for some reason, right? So it's somewhere along the line she's encountered the notion that something, that your soul continues to exist, that its state is in question, and that prayer might be connected to the ultimate state of your soul after death. So she's got that, but she doesn't have what? She doesn't have any practices. She doesn't have any habits. She's never been part of a community where prayer was an essential element, where she had a language for thinking about death and the soul. I think that is, to me, a really startling theological moment in contemporary film. Not because it presents a fully worked out theology, but because it comes right up against what's missing in our culture. And it comes up against it in a much more honest way than most depictions of death in the vast majority of Hollywood films. So that those two, I think, the Batman Begins and then the Gravity piece, give us, I think, something of what Lewis is talking about when he says we need to be aware of what's missing, what's absent in our culture. And let me read this great passage from the end of The Four Loves. This goes back to the wake up thing that I mentioned earlier about Lewis. If we cannot practice the presence of God, that is, if we don't feel habituated to this experience of God being present to us at every moment. Lewis said it's something to practice the absence of God, to become increasingly aware of our unawareness, till we feel like men who should stand beside a great cataract, a waterfall, and hear no noise. Or like in a man in a story who looks in a mirror and finds no face there. Right? Think about if you woke up and looked in the mirror and nothing looked back. That's what Lewis is talking about. Or if you were standing near a plane taking off and you heard nothing, and it wasn't because you were physically deaf. Or a man in a dream who stretches out his hand to visible objects and gets no sense of touch. To know that one is dreaming is to be no longer perfectly asleep. So Lewis is saying this is our condition. We are so far from God, not simply because of sin, but because of the distance between the finite and the infinite. We are so far from God that we are like someone who looks at his own face in the mirror and sees nothing. We think we capture God in our words and our language, our concepts, but God is infinitely beyond that, infinitely richer, truer, more wise, more loving. So Lewis says it's really important for us to practice an awareness of how unaware we are. This is one of the crucial roles of art, is to take us out of the situation where we're comfortable and think we understand everything, and make us realize that in that world we were as sleeping people being awakened from a dream into a reality that's much richer. To be aware that you are dreaming is to no longer be fully asleep. Remember that, we've all had that moment, right, when we're half awake, half asleep, and wondering whether we're dreaming or not. And if it's a scary dream, we're trying to wake ourselves up and find out if there's a threat in the room where we are, and we're trying to pull ourselves out of it. Well, that Lewis is talking about, that's our experience with the whole of reality. That's our situation. And to be beginning to pull ourselves out of, to be aware that we are asleep, is to no longer be completely asleep. And art has that role for Lewis. Let me say, I want to try to leave time for questions, but let me talk about one other topic briefly, and maybe we'll show this clip at the end from The Passion of the Christ, which is something I think is worth, it's a really moving clip from that film. So Lewis is interested in fantasy, and I don't have time to develop his notion of fantasy completely. We're obsessed with fantasy in our culture, right? If you look at the best-selling films from about the year 2000, if you're a kind of film geek like me, you go onto a website called Box Office Mojo, and it can give you the bestsellers for this year, for the past 10 years. It can rate them by category, by RPG. It can also adjust them for inflation. It can do whatever you want. But if you go back from 2000 to now, in the top 10 every year, you're going to find lots of superhero movies, right? And you're going to find all the Star Wars movies. You're going to find Harry Potter movies. You're going to find the Lord of the Rings movies. Any movie with a spider in it, top 10, guaranteed. So if you want to be a successful filmmaker, just start taking pictures of spiders. You can be a top 10 movie. What's interesting about that is it's fantasy. There are also a lot of quest movies in there as well. I have mixed views about our current fantasy films. I mean, I think they, when they're really good, like the Batman films, they really do present us with some depth in thinking about good and evil. One of the problems with most superhero films is that the villains are often cartoonish. They're just there to kind of physically threaten. They're not. There's no depth to their evil. Hitchcock, the great master of suspense, said, "The better the villain, the better the film." And I think when you've got a contrast between good and evil, that's true. You need something about evil that's kind of complicated and mysterious to bring out the richness of goodness opposing it. They don't often have really rich. There's also something about the superhero films that I think feeds into our obsession with technology and the way in which we think we can reshape the world to our wishes. You know, Tolkien thought that magic and technology were basically the same thing, because they're both about what? They're about reducing to the vanishing point the gap between I want it and it appears, right? So we had the lights off in here a few minutes ago. When we wanted it to become light again, we hit the switch. If we were in a Harry Potter book or film, we would have pulled out our wand and said Lumos, right? And then everything would have lit up. That's what magic is about. Magic is about our power reducing the gap to nothingness between I want it and it appears. What you don't get in a lot of the superhero films is any worry about the use of magic. The great thing in The Lord of the Rings, and as you probably know, Lewis and Tolkien were very close friends, part of this group called the Inklings. They helped one another work out the plots of their books, the Narnia books and the Lord of the Rings books. The great thing about the Lord of the Rings series is that the one thing you can't do is to use the most powerful technological tool at your disposal for good, the ring, the one ring to rule them all, right? That there are certain uses of technology that we ought to resist. This is at the root of the wisdom of Catholic bioethics, right? That there are certain things about our technology with respect to human nature, certain things that are permitted, other things that are really dangerous. Why? Because there are certain powers over nature and over ourselves that once we wield them, we can't but destroy ourselves. Right? And Lewis and Tolkien had a sense of this. I don't think a lot of our superhero films do. Lewis also had, I think, a sense of something that's become really prominent in our culture. How many of you have read or seen the first Narnia? Okay, so many of you. So you know how that ends with Aslan offering his life, right, for another. And there's a discussion at the end about the deep magic and the deeper magic, right? And the deep magic that's woven into Narnia is that the White Witch who controls Narnia, who's a demonic character, right, that anyone who is a traitor to her, she has the right to kill. So it is the deep magic is the magic of retribution and vengeance. Justice, but understood in a very limited way as retribution and vengeance. She has no notion of the deeper magic, right? And let me read this passage here. The deep magic that all traitors' lives are forfeited to the White Witch. If she had looked back before the dawn of time, she would have read a different magic. There's a magic deeper still which she did not know. Her magic goes only back to the dawn of time. If she could have looked a little further, before time, she would have read there a different incantation. She would have known that when a willing victim who had committed no treachery was killed in a traitor's stead, the table would crack and death itself would start working backwards. So that when there is, the deep magic is the magic of revenge, right? Of injustice being corrected by murder, by capital punishment. The deeper magic is that when an innocent victim substitutes himself for a guilty person, the deeper magic kicks in and death reverses itself. So the deeper magic is the magic of sacrificial death leading to resurrection. Right? But this is a magic before time. This is divine magic. What we have in our culture is an awful lot of the deep magic in our popular film. We have a lot of the deep magic. I think that, let me say a word about the Hunger Games and then play this clip. I'll try to pack all this in 5 minutes and then leave 10 minutes for play. I think that really you all know something about the Hunger Games. Everybody knows Jennifer Lawrence and Katniss and all of that stuff. So you have a community, you have Panem, right, where the districts had rebelled against the central authority, and as punishment for a certain number of years, the districts all had to serve up a male and female to fight one another to the death until there's a victor. Suzanne Collins, who wrote the original book, said she got the idea for this by watching CNN during the Gulf War, first Gulf War, and flipping from depictions of war to reality TV shows. And she wasn't critiquing war so much as she was critiquing the way in which we receive moment to moment as we're flipping around the TV or looking at our screens. We move from images of serious issues of violence and suffering to the Kardashians, whatever it is that's on, or if you're from Waco, we only show Fixer Upper in Waco. That's all we show on reality TV is Fixer Upper. It's good stuff there. Chip and Joanna are Baylor alums, so we want to promote them whenever we can. But we move from really serious, grave matters to superficial matters. So, and I think we begin to feel what I call CNN compassion. Right, we flip on CNN, see some image of horror, we say, oh, that's awful, and then we switch to a sporting event or to reality TV. And this, the way in which even suffering and violence can become sources of entertainment for us is what Collins had in mind in writing The Hunger Games. I mean, if we enjoy The Hunger Games, we've got to ask ourselves, why? Right now, as it progresses, there are actually good people to cheer for in these battles. But if we're at the beginning, what are we watching? We're watching innocent young people murder one another. We're like the people in Panem with all of their artificial hair and all of that, what? Feeling bound together by ritualized violence of the innocent killing one another. Right? This is all over the place in our popular culture. Right? Ritualized violence of the innocent killing one another, or bad people killing one another, or whatever it might be. But then the violence goes from being something that we ought to have an emotional and moral reaction to, that is pulling for good people, hoping the innocent are protected, hoping the evil ones are defeated and whatever reasonable means can be used. We then become jaded viewers who are entertained by violence itself. So that's the question of the Hunger Games series, is are we becoming a people like that? That would be to say that we would be in the white witches' camp, right? We're looking at fights where one people counters another and they fight unto the death. That's not even quite the deep magic, right? It's even lower than the deep, it's sort of shallow magic. The white witch has a deep magic. The deeper magic, though, I want to end with this clip from The Passion of the Christ. So before I do that, I think this is, I mean, what to say about Mel Gibson, who's in his personal life and his speech has very often been a kind of vile, as many people who live in Hollywood are, as we know more and more from reports about behavior. This film, though, is I think, problematic in the sense that Gibson knows this culture of violence and how we're entertained by violence. Most of his films are about this. I think the weakness of the film is that it focuses for too long in too many places simply on the mutilation of Christ's body. You've seen the film. So what does that do? that deadens our imagination to the reality of the suffering and its significance. I think that's a danger in the film. That would be, and I've got a review online of a film where I tried to spell this out after it came out. But, as certain scholars have said, Jesus was subjected to the two most brutal, excruciating forms of punishment that the Romans had available to them. Sustained flogging and public crucifixion. So it is, in one sense, hard to overstate how horrifying was the violence that was done to his physical body. Yet, as believers, our focus is not on merely the physical. In fact, it's pretty late in the history of the church that you start to see depictions of Christ on the cross where he's bleeding. Right? Early depictions don't do that, but it does become part of mainstream Catholic devotion. I do think there are some scenes, and I want to end with this clip from the Passion. And there are especially scenes where Mary is involved. And this is a brilliant thing that Gibson does in this scene. Let's end with this. That's the deeper magic. What Lewis is talking about. That's the deeper magic. We take a couple of questions. I talked too long. Yes, in the back. Say that again. Not so much a critique. Lewis is. I think Lewis's best, Till We Have Faces is probably his best fiction book, I think. Lewis's strongest area of writing is his essays, I think. I don't think he was generally a great fiction writer. I don't think the Narnia books I think they're good, and they're, but they're, when I'm reading them, I'm always thinking of Lord of the Rings and thinking how far superior Lord of the Rings is as a work. And I think this is, almost everyone thinks that, so I'm not being some sort of rebel critic of Lewis by saying this. But Lewis's attempt to match characters and to sort of allegorical figures and that sort of thing to represent them, present them as allegorical figures, I think it becomes a bit pedestrian in parts, and so they are more like children's stories than the Lord of the Rings, which can also be read to precocious kids, but are adult. And I think the Lord of the Rings, one of the things I think you figure this out, which is superior, which one do you really want to reread? And which one do you keep learning from when you reread? I don't learn that much when I reread the Narnia books. They're entertaining, they're morally and theologically uplifting. So that would be my reservation about Lewis. I think his essays, though, are just brilliant. Yeah. Right here.
Sir, you mentioned earlier that the most superhero movies don't go into any kind of technology or anything that should be taboo across the board. Can you think of any examples, like The Dark Knight or anything like that, where that topic is at least approached and is discarded or something like that?
So I think this is the lingering influence of someone like Tolkien on J.K. Rowling, because it's certainly a topic in the Harry Potter books. What kind of curses can you use and what can't you use? Right? So, and actually the magic in Harry Potter, I've got a really good colleague, Alan Jacobs, who's an evangelical at Baylor, and he wrote about when the Harry Potter books first came out, there were a lot of evangelicals equating the magic there to the occult. It's not the occult. And in fact, it's more like what Tolkien thought it was, that magic is a stand-in for technology or how we control the external world and our own bodies. And so I don't know that she works it out consistently, Rowling, the way that Tolkien does, but she's constantly raising the question. Her characters, her main characters, are raising the question, what kind of magic can we use and what can't we use? Yeah, in the back.
I kind of like in movies like this. So the movies that draw my attention a lot are those ones with immersion. So I'm thinking like Tears of the Sun.
Yeah.
The moment where they're like, our sins be forgiven.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then there's a moment of transitioning from the evil men to the good men.
Yeah.
Or I think Constantine, which got a lot of like religious kind of stuff
yeah.
there. But he's basically doomed in hell because he's suicide according to that theology. But that's not what he
right.
But then at the very end, I can spoil that evil.
Yeah.
Same kind of evil.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think there are, just as there are scenes where people are facing death and trying to prepare themselves, pretty rare, there are probably more scenes of conversion where you have people coming to some, you're going to know that I had a really misspent middle adulthood when I mentioned this test example, and maybe we should end on that before I really lose your respect completely. But as you were saying that, I was thinking of the character Spike in the Buffy the Vampire Slayer series. See, I just ruined it all, didn't I, by bringing that up? I actually wrote an essay about Buffy and evil. But there's a character there, Spike, who is, at a certain point, who's the most rambunctious and kind of wild of the vampire characters. But he spends an entire season trying to repent. And there's actually a scene with him draping himself over a cross that is astonishing in the sense that it really does capture a character who's trying to atone for his sins, and it uses explicitly religious imagery to do so. Thank you all.
Sir, if I can ask you a quick question of you, for anyone that your message hit hard or they really liked, is there anything you suggest in your writings that they consult or go to first?
I don't know. I've got a website, thomashibbs.org, where with a bunch of reviews on it. I reviewed the latest Shyamalan movie, thumbs down. Sorry. I mean, I'm a fan of a lot of his stuff, but you could. And the Shows About Nothing book is.
Shows About Nothing.
Yeah. If you want to read a long book about nothing, that's the one.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Can we give another round of applause?